21,000 others injured. The regime's forces blew up several residential buildings east of Jabalia and Beit Lahia, both in northern Gaza. They also detonated a residential complex in the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. In the Al-Shajaiya neighborhood of the city, Israeli forces detonated an explosive-laden armored vehicle as the regime's gunboats opened fire off the coast of Khan Yunis. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Mosape, to get the latest updates on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-ravaged territory. Let's take a listen.
Let me start with the fresh wave of the destructive air raids that targeted, as you know, the eastern sides of Khan Yunis city and Rafah city as well. I would like to remind you with what happened to the Pasina people in the eastern side of Bani Suhaila area, whereas, as you know, hundreds of the Pasina families that were taking shelter in one of the schools in that area found themselves all of a sudden, as you know, inside the areas located beyond the so-called yellow line. So this reflects how the Israeli occupation forces on the ground are annexing more lands of the Palestinian territories and the Palestinian lands in Gaza Strip. They are still moving the yellow marks on a daily basis. The Israeli occupation forces have intensified and scaled up their brutal attacks against several parts, particularly in Jabalia refugee camp, in addition to Beit Lahia city. Those areas witnessed more demolitions of the Palestinian residential buildings. Needless to mention that the eastern side of Gaza City is still one of the focal points of those frequent violations of the ceasefire agreement, because the Israeli forces are still, as you know, destroying and demolishing more residential buildings in that area. So the current situation is absolutely precarious and horrific for the Palestinian people in several parts of Gaza, particularly the eastern outskirts along the so-called yellow line in the eastern section of Gaza generally.
Most families in Gaza are living in tents they've built themselves, scraping together whatever wood pieces found to keep them standing. With Israel's blockade still preventing essential supplies from entering, many lose their shelters again and again. In western Khan Yunis, a makeshift workshop has started repurposing wood to offer families an alternative. Ahmed Al-Najja reports from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed Al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
December 9th marks the UN's Genocide Prevention Day. Pakistan has commemorated the event with a seminar focusing on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Participants have condemned the Gaza genocide, urging Muslim unity to put an end to it. Correspondent Nasser Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries. Those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices and it is then forgotten. Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire. The massacres continue. The genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
November 29th marks the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. On that day and the following days, various ceremonies are held around the world to commemorate the occasion. Ethiopia held a solidarity ceremony on Tuesday at a UN headquarters in Addis Ababa. Emmanuel Gebremedin was there and sent us this report.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent Israeli occupation, which has relentlessly targeted our land, the people, and every aspect of life in Palestine, culminating in an atrocious genocide in the Gaza Strip, confirmed by numerous UN and international human rights reports.
Injustice also continues in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, with Israel military operations, settlers, violence, settlement expansions, evictions, demolitions, and threats of annexations. At the same time, hundreds of humanitarian workers have been killed. The majority were Palestinians, UN staff, marking the largest loss of personnel in the organization's history. More journalists have perished than in any other conflict since the Second World War.
Participants expressed support for the Palestinians' legitimate rights including the right to have independent states.
The Middle East region will not be able to emerge from the successive crises unless the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to establish his own independent state are recognized.
Despite the UN's annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people and global calls to address the ongoing crisis, Palestinians continue to face a grave ordeal in the history of humanity. And this event in Addis Ababa urges the international community to move beyond rhetoric and support the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people in their quest for self-determination.
As we reflect on the hardship endured by millions of Palestinians, we are reminded that solidarity is not merely symbolic. It is a moral imperative. It is a wake-up call to the international community to redouble its commitment.
The event concluded with the 40 exhibition featuring the tragedies occurring in Gaza, honoring ambassadors whose countries have recognized the state of Palestine, and the flag-raising ceremony. Amani El-Gabramatin, Addis Ababa.
Israeli forces and settlers continue to launch violent attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and vandalizing their property. On Tuesday, different areas of the West Bank witnessed a surge in settler violence, including arson attacks on homes and vehicles and assaults on farmers. A Palestinian farmer was abducted by extremist Israeli settlers in a town west of Bethlehem. In a separate incident, a Palestinian house and two vehicles were set on fire in southern Bethlehem. In the south of the occupied city of Al-Khalil, Israeli settlers attacked the Bedouin community, hurling stones and Molotov cocktails at their homes. In Masafer Yatta, armed settlers assaulted Palestinian farmers, driving them off their lands. The occupied Ramallah was also the scene of Israeli violence, where a group of settlers attacked cars and blocked the road leading to the city, while the regime forces demolished three homes and displaced their residents. We were earlier joined by our West Bank correspondent, Nara Hamed, for an update on the Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory. Let's take a listen.
The PRCS have informed that they have received three freed Palestinians from inside Israeli jails that has been severely beaten by the Israeli soldiers in the checkpoint of Al-Jib during being released and during being set to freedom. They were severely beaten to the extent that they needed medical care inside a Palestinian hospital to the northeast of occupied Ramallah. Precisely, the village of Al-Mughayr is under attack again, as the Israeli forces are targeting this village. Precisely, incursion and a raid happened towards the universities of Bir Zeit to the north of Ramallah and Abu Dis to the south of occupied Al-Quds. The Israeli forces until now have plowed have bulldozed more than 700 dunams in the area of Qaryut, which represents a great loss for the Palestinians in that area. If we have to go to Jenin, where the Israeli forces are making a raid towards Yabad, and for more than 1 month now, there are some Palestinian homes inside Yabad that has been evacuated from their residents, and they have been turned into military outposts inside Yabad.
Hundreds of protesters have taken to the streets of the Norwegian capital, Oslo, demonstrating against Venezuelan opposition leader Marina Corina Machado. Machado is expected to receive her Nobel Peace Prize on Wednesday.
It's about giving the Peace Prize to Maria Corina Machado, because we don't think that she's worthy of the Peace Prize. She has not, she has supported the American actions outside Venezuela against the civilians bombing the boats, and also that she has expressed that she is positive to American intervention in her own country. She's not a peace person. she has supported the Trump administration and their actions against outside Venezuela, and also intervention in her country.
Protesters waved Venezuela's flags and chanted anti-war slogans. They expressed their opposition to the Nobel Peace Prize being used to legitimize military intervention in other countries. They were referring to Machado welcoming the United States' military buildup in the Caribbean and President Donald Trump's threats to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Machado has been under scrutiny for her alignment with Trump's anti-Maduro campaign after she dedicated her Peace Prize to the U.S. president. The Oslo ceremony comes after the United States carried out multiple deadly strikes against boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific waters, which have left more than 80 people dead. Washington claims the strikes are part of a military campaign against regional drug cartels. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days from the heart of region to the global stage. God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about growing pressure on Pete Hegseth to step down as Pentagon chief with twin scandals engulfing America's war secretary. Pete Hegseth is facing the most serious crisis of his tenure as war secretary, engulfed by allegations of war crimes in the Caribbean and blistering Inspector General report accusing him of mishandling classified military intelligence. Yet despite the long list of trouble and as lawmakers from both political parties call for his resignation, Hegseth showed no sign of stepping down and still has the support of President Trump. The twin crises have engulfed the former Fox News personality in separate but overlapping allegations that lawmakers, policy experts, and former officials say reveal a pattern of dangerous recklessness at the helm of the Pentagon. Democratic legislators have reignited calls for his ouster after revelations that survivors clinging to a wreckage from a September boat strike were deliberately killed in a double-tap attack. And this may be classified as a war crime. While a Defense Department investigation released on Thursday concluded he violated Pentagon policies by sharing sensitive details via the Signal messaging app just hours before airstrike in Yemen. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Meron Derakhshand.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, the most recent controversy comes at the Caribbean Campaign Center's on the Trump administration extrajudicial strike against suspected drug smugglers in the Caribbean Sea. Tell us more about that.
Yes, calls are mounting for Donald Trump's Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign over an alleged illegal airstrike against a suspected Venezuelan drug smuggling boat. On 2nd of September this year, a U.S. missile hit a vessel, killing several people on board the vessel, although two men survived the initial attack.
Mm-hmm.
But a second airstrike was then ordered to kill both men while they clung on to the wreckage of the boat,
right,
a direct violation of the Geneva Convention, to which the United States is a signatory.
Mm-hmm.
Since the attack, the United States has produced no evidence showing the men were transporting drugs on a boat that experts say could not make the 1,400-mile journey to the United States.
Right.
The two dead men's families say they were just fishermen. Since the attack, the United States has produced no evidence showing the men were transporting drugs on a boat that experts say could not make the 1,400-mile journey to the United States. The two dead men's families say they were just fishermen. Critics, including members of Pete Hegseth's own Republican Party, say that targeting defenseless survivors amounts to potential war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Senator Mike Rounds said, "I think the first thing we need to do is to get to the facts. We're just going to get to the facts first."
Mm-hmm.
Now, Democratic Senator Susan Collins warned that killing people from a wrecked ship would be wrong under international law. And Senator Jim Justice called the double strike unacceptable, arguing that he supported the war on drugs,
mm-hmm,
but he did not support killing of defenseless people clinging on to the wreckage of a boat.
Right.
The Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, whom Donald Trump has renamed Secretary of War, has cited the fog of war in defense of the blow-up strike that killed two survivors from the initial strike on the boat.
Right.
Hegseth has repeatedly gloated on social media about the U.S. naval attacks, posting graphic footage of the airstrike.
Mm-hmm.
His comments came on the day the leader of the world's Catholics, Pope Leo, urged Donald Trump not to try to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro using military force.
Yeah.
Now, Donald Trump has justified the Caribbean campaign as essential to combating fentanyl trafficking, claiming that each destroyed vessel saves 25,000 American lives.
Mm-hmm.
Though various former officials and drug policy experts and fact-checkers have all called this figure absurd, noting that fentanyl primarily enters the United States by land from Mexico and not via the sea from Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
The legality of their airstrikes came under intense scrutiny after the public learned that two men who survived the initial 2nd of September attack could be seen amid the wreckage when a lethal follow-up airstrike was ordered.
Right.
While the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth initially dismissed the reporting of this incident as fabricated, but he later acknowledged and confirmed the basic facts during a cabinet meeting this week. He said he acted in the fog of war, but he also said he didn't stick around to observe the rest of the mission.
Yeah. Senator Patty Murray, the Democratic Vice Chair of the Senate Appropriation Committee, has called for a Pete Hegseth firing. What are the Democrats saying about Hegseth?
Yes, the Democratic Senator Patty Murray, the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, called for Pete Hegseth's firing after a bipartisan briefing on this incident where two survivors of the initial attack on the boat, clinging on to the wreckage of the boat, they were both killed in a second airstrike on the same boat.
Right.
Now, Senator Patty Murray, Democratic Senator, said, "Between overseeing this campaign in the Caribbean, risking U.S. service members' lives by sharing war plans on Signal messaging app, and so much else, it could not be more obvious that Secretary Hegseth is unfit for the role, and it is past time for him to go. The New Democratic Coalition, the largest Democratic caucus in the House with 116 members, who describe themselves as fiscally moderate, issued their own statement calling Pete Hegseth incompetent, reckless, and a threat to the lives of the men and women who serve in the United States Armed Forces. The New Democrat Coalition Chair, Brad Schneider, and National Security Working Group Chair, Jill Cisneros, accused the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, of lying, deflecting, and scapegoating subordinates while refusing to take any accountability and responsibility. Yeah. Time and time again, the Secretary has lied, dodged, deflected, and shockingly scapegoated his subordinates, they said. He's a disgrace to the office that he holds and should resign immediately before his actions cost the lives of Americans. Mm-hmm. Now, Emily Tripp, executive director of Air Wars, a civilian harms watchdog that monitors military conflicts, called on the Trump administration to be more transparent about the airstrikes in the Caribbean Sea, saying the organization would like to know what considerations are made around shipwreck survivors and why the use of force was chosen over search and rescue, when, as far as we understand, the targets here are the drugs in the boats, mm-hmm. not the actual people on board the boats.
Right.
The Pentagon mixed up its talking points and struggled to provide clear answers about the chain of command for the airstrikes. While the White House initially suggested that Admiral Frank Bradley, commander of the Southern Command Special Operations, ordered the follow-up strike on the wreckage of the boat, Pete Hegseth later said that Admiral Bradley made the call with his authorization and had complete authority to act independently. But what has President Trump said about this? Well, President Trump has claimed that he and Hegseth knew nothing about the operational details of this. Trump even suggested he would not have wanted the second airstrike on the wreckage of the boat.
Yeah.
So that's the situation
I
there.
See. Yeah. The Defense Department Inspector General report released on Thursday concluded that Hegseth violated Pentagon policies by using Signal to share precise details about upcoming airstrike on Yemen. Can you provide us with more details about this?
Yes, I can. Compounding Pete Hegseth's bad week, a report by Pentagon's Inspector General has concluded that he violated Pentagon policies by using the Signal messaging app to share precise details about upcoming airstrikes in Yemen, including the quantity and airstrike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory approximately 2 to 4 hours before the missions were executed on 15th of March this year.
Mm-hmm.
The report by Pentagon's Inspector General determined that Hegseth's actions created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S. pilots. The information, which was marked as secret and not to be shared with foreign nationals, was transmitted via Pete Hegseth's unclassified personal device in group chats with other Trump administration officials. The investigation also found that Hegseth failed to retain all associated messages, violating federal record-keeping requirements.
I see.
Now, Senator Jack Reed, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, said the report made clear that Secretary Hegseth violated Department of Defense policies and shared information that was classified at the time it was sent to him.
Right.
These were precise strike timings and locations that, had they fallen into enemy hands, could have enabled the Houthis in Yemen to target American pilots. So Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has actually defended Pete Hegseth's actions, saying that Hegseth was within his authority to do what he did. But he's the only one who's actually defended Hegseth. All the other senators have attacked Hegseth and described him as incompetent and putting U.S. service members' lives at risk, U.S. pilots' lives at risk, precisely because of what he did.
You are listening. listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Some Republicans have also expressed their own concerns about Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the vast majority of senators who have criticized Pete Hegseth have been Democratic senators, but a number of Republicans have also expressed their own concerns about the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican senator, suggested that Hegseth had lied about the September boat attack, saying the Defense Secretary either was lying to us or he's incompetent and didn't know it had happened. Republican Congressman Don Bacon told CNN he had seen enough to conclude that Pete Hegseth was not the right leader for the Pentagon.
Right.
Pete Hegseth's tenure has also been marked by severe dysfunction inside the Pentagon itself, mm-hmm. where his own aides earlier this year have been leaking against one another and informing on colleagues in what multiple officials described as a paranoid and chaotic atmosphere inside the Pentagon. The Defense Secretary used a leaked investigation, which the White House had reportedly lost confidence in, to purge three top advisors in the spring, with claims that they were identified through what would amount to an illegal, warrantless National Security Agency wiretap. The episode again raised fresh questions about Pete Hegseth's judgment and his ability to manage the Pentagon.
Right. Will Pete Hegseth be forced to resign as a Pentagon chief?
Well, that's a very good question. And the short answer to that is, it is unlikely that he'll be forced to resign. It is unlikely that he will be forced to resign. Because despite the twin controversies, you know, the controversy over the second attack on the boat, the two people clinging onto the wreckage being killed in the second direct attack on that boat, and the report by Pentagon's Inspector General, which revealed that Pete Hegseth has revealed classified information on a messaging app. So despite those two twin controversies creating what lawmakers have described as an untenable situation for Pete Hegseth, the War Secretary, Donald Trump has continued to back Pete Hegseth publicly, with the White House expressing the utmost confidence in its national security team.
Yeah.
Now, since the Senate is controlled by Republicans and Donald Trump is maintaining his support of Pete Hegseth, Hegseth is unlikely to face any meaningful consequences, meaning that he's unlikely to be forced to tender his resignation.
Yeah, right, I see. To sum up very briefly then, there are calls by both Democratic and Republican senators for Pete Hegseth to resign as War Secretary. Lawmakers have expressed concern about Hegseth's tendency to push the blame onto his subordinates. However, Donald Trump's support for Hegseth means that he will probably survive as War Secretary. Thank you, Mr. Rakshana, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone from heaven. You can heal my soul alone.
Thank you for joining us this hour. Several issues were highlighted by Hebrew media, most notably the U.S. demand to move forward with the second phase of the Gaza Agreement, the aggression against the occupied West Bank and the Zionist projects there, as well as the situation in the north on the border with Lebanon. Also on the agenda was the recruitment of Israeli spies for Iran. We will discuss these topics with Dr. Mohsen Saleh, president of the International Association of Political Experts, joining us here from our studios in Beirut. Hello and welcome, Dr.
Well, thank you. Welcome to you. Thanks.
It appears that the Americans are rushing to begin the second phase of the Gaza Agreement, even though the first phase has not yet ended, as the occupation is still waiting to receive the body of the last captive from the Gaza Strip, according to Hebrew media. Do you think that actually Trump will be able to commence the implementation of the second step of the Gaza Agreement? And do you think that he will force Netanyahu to implement it during their own anticipated visit in Florida?
Well, it seems that Trump is able to force Netanyahu and the Israeli government in order to stop or retaliate or to start to initiate the war. It seems also that Netanyahu is surrendering to the Trump's orders, and the rest is for Trump in order to delineate the map for New Gaza. What does he want from Gaza? Still the peace, what they call peace council, presided by Tony Blair, and also the members, it doesn't seem that they have done anything final. That's why Netanyahu said it yesterday. He said that he will withdraw till the yellow line. And Yael Zemir said that this new line will be the final line for the Israeli forces to withdraw to and leave the rest. What is the rest? The shore and the southern part of Gaza, where the probably gas and oil
resources
there in the sea, in the Palestinian Sea, we have to wait. I guess they are not certain yet till the point and the map from Tony Blair and from Jared Kushner and from Witkoff to come to be implemented. Otherwise, the Israelis, well, they have meeting today, probably, or yesterday, between the Qataris, the highest officers in the intelligence services from Qatar and Israel and the United States. They have to meet in order to distribute the roles of each one of these teams. And probably also the Turks might join in order to finalize the map for New Gaza. And they differ about the arms of Hamas. Some of them say, well, let's give the Palestinian authorities these arms, or try to hide them under the auspices of some of the regional countries, probably Egypt, or probably Qatar with Egypt. Till now, I guess we don't have anything final regarding the withdrawal of the Israelis from the complete Gaza, and also the process of putting the Palestinians, where are they going to concentrate the Palestinians, which camps, and what kind of assistance, and Netanyahu talked about the opening of Rafah gate, and the Egyptians said there will be a kind of mutual or exchange between the coming and the going.
Okay, so will Trump be able to impose this on Netanyahu, taking into consideration that, according to the Israelis, the first phase has not yet ended? They're still waiting for the crops of the
Trump own captain. Trump asked the president in Israel to pardon Netanyahu from his guilt and try to bring him innocent. And the Israelis want him to remorse or repent or say something about his actions, his corruption, actually. But till now, we don't know. We don't know to what extent Trump want Netanyahu to withdraw or to press him to surrender to his ideas, because Netanyahu always say we want to continue opening the pressure on Hamas, on Gaza, on the Gazans, he said. And they try about these collaborators with them, although the Palestinians, they have killed Abu Shabab, the collaborator and the spy, and who is doing great job for the Israelis, and they said it. But I guess still the situation is too foggy to judge about the final steps for the map of Gaza.
Okay. In the occupied West Bank, despite the escalation, Hebrew media revealed contacts taking place between the occupation authorities and the Palestinian Authority regarding the situation of the Palestinian camps there and the conditions the occupation is trying to impose on the Palestinian authorities. How do you interpret the Israeli contact with the Palestinian Authority?
Well, I guess till now the Palestinian Authority is condemning the steps taken, the military steps taken in the West Bank, and otherwise they have no will, neither the plan to confront the Israelis in the situation of Gaza. And they are surrendering, it seems, to the American and to the Israeli forces and dictations. But I guess Trump said to Netanyahu, don't confiscate or don't try to put West Bank under your political hegemony. And Netanyahu said it, the political future of the West Bank till now is not determined, is not final. So they have problem with the Palestinian, the camps, the refugees from the 1948 to the West Bank. And now they are trying to cut all the aids from the UNRWA and from others.
Exactly, and that's what I wanted
in order
to ask. Why are they insisting on cutting from not only the UNRWA, but also the International Relief Organization in these camps?
Their problem is that these refugees want to ask about their future and their right to return to the 1948. If there will be any plan for peace accord, new accord, they have to take in their consideration that these Palestinians, they have the right to go back, or if they stay in the West Bank, they have to have a kind of aegis or kind of protection or kind of aids from the UNRWA. The Israelis want to cut all kinds of aids from the UNRWA, and they want to kick out the UNRWA from the whole Palestinian territories.
Okay.
That's another problem for the United Nations and for the Americans and even for the Western powers,
okay,
France
however,
and England.
Yes.
That's,
however, some Israeli commentators have called for adopting what they described as an offensive doctrine, arguing that Israel has relied over the years on a defensive posture which can no longer work. Has Israel relied on a defensive doctrine in the past years?
This is a big lie. This is an empty narrative and stories from these fantasious minds, and they don't understand what kind of offense or defense they are talking about. The Israelis always have this doctrine of offense and attack against others, and the concept of aggression is theirs against
so
the Arabs, against the Palestinians, their massacres.
Why do they advertise online?
Because there has been and still there will be, and now there is resistance against these offensive attacks, expeditions against the Palestinians and against the Arabs in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria. Look what they are doing in Syria. Look what they are doing in the West Bank. Look what they are doing in Gaza. And they are threatening and attacking Yemen, reaching and attacking Iraq. So this is what they call doctrine of defense.
Okay, so this is something
what kind
new.
Of defense? This is a big lie. This is a big lie. This is a fake story about the political and military situation from the beginning or from the early century of the 20th century, not from now. They have been doing
attacking
attacks
Yemen
against
and attacking Iran is new.
They said that they say that they should attack any place where can be or might be a threat against the Israelis and might be attacked from these areas. But
okay.
These areas haven't attacked. The Israelis who have been attacking, and these
okay,
were,
but isn't this
were
new,
helping
Dr. Mohsen?
The Palestinians only.
Yeah,
no?
Isn't this new?
This is new, but they are creating a new concept based on lies that we have been defending ourselves, as if they were historically there as a state or as a camp or even as a society. There will be a kind of, new mythology of the Israeli mind about their existence or being occupying the Palestinian land. And the Palestinians would say, oh, we have been attacking the Israelis from the early 20th century, and they have been defending themselves. What kind of history, what kind of events, what kind of days, what
yes.
kind of thinking, what kind of ideas, what kind of philosophy, what kind of religion, what kind of a human being? They have been attacking massacres from Deir Yassin and Kfar Qasim and Meis and Hula in Lebanon, and attacking everybody. For the sake of the West, and for the sake of the Zionism.
Turning to Lebanon, as you mentioned, Dr. Mohsen, and to the warlike atmosphere promoted by the Israeli occupation on this front, which has caused northern settlers to fear the resumption of war with Hezbollah, as indicated by the head of the Metula Settlement Council near the Lebanese border. What do you think of this discontent that is spread among the North settlers, as expressed here by the head of the Metula Settlement Council, Dr. Mohsen?
Well, they also depend on lies that Hezbollah is going to attack them or Hezbollah is there. Hezbollah is there because people are there. The southern part of Lebanon, the people there are having this eagerness, this longing for their land, that's why they are afraid from the people of the south. And I guess if they are creating a kind of fear, a kind of, I guess it has been always from 1985, especially in 1993, 1996, till 2000, when the resistance in Lebanon achieved this great victory against the Israelis. And from that time, the Israeli settlers there, they think that Hezbollah is going to attack them. However, the Israelis always the attackers and the aggressors against the Lebanese there.
Okay.
And that's why the Lebanese in South Lebanon, they don't forget the either their massacres, the Israeli massacres against Qana and Kfar Tibnit and other places in South Lebanon.
But do you think that the factor of northern settlements could influence the decision to launch a war, on Lebanon by Netanyahu's administration?
Well, here we have a great dilemma for the Israelis, for the Israeli military mind. And the existence of the Americans. We can say now America is controlling the area, controlling the Israelis, and controlling also the Lebanese, the official Lebanese. And now the Israelis are stuck in the idea of not having been able to initiate a wide war or a war against Lebanon and reaching to Beirut. If
okay.
they want to do that, that means the international community, well, especially the French and the Americans, they see that any war might deteriorate the situation until they cannot control it.
Okay.
And Hezbollah,
okay.
and not only Hezbollah, even the Arab people, I'm talking about the resistance in
yes.
the region, will regain its mentality of having to do something in order to defend itself.
Yes. Now let's listen to some of the Israeli social media commentary on the issue of Lebanon and Hezbollah.
Edgar, slowly but surely, Hezbollah is recovering and preparing for the next round. As long as the ideology of destroying us is strong and in place, will always find alternatives and new leaders. Israel Mitzaf, in Hezbollah's view, adding a Lebanese civilian representative to the dialogue with Israel is surrender. Washington and Riyadh forced the three Lebanese presidents to negotiate politically. Amdot Krav, it would have been better for us to keep the war against Hezbollah rather than stop fighting it.
Meanwhile, the Hebrew media revealed the security measures that the occupation authorities have begun taking to limit espionage operations for the benefit of the Iranians within Israeli society. Do you believe that the occupation can successfully or are capable of limiting security, intelligence, and even social penetrations of Zionists by the Iranians?
No, I think the future in the hands of the resistance and the Iranians.
They
have been making these campaigns for a long time, and
yes.
Hezbollah penetrated their intelligence services and reached to many information and data from the Israelis by listening
yes.
or eardropping or all of these kinds of intelligence services.
Okay.
However, they have. Technically speaking, they have, from the Americans, they have all kinds of, let's say, intelligence weapons, more than regular intelligence
okay.
Machines. They have more complicated and sophisticated machines. They can probably overcome some of
okay.
their problems, but I guess the Iranians and Hezbollah and Hamas and everybody
okay.
who have been attacked
yes.
by the Israelis, they have to defend themselves.
Our time is up. Dr. Mohsen Saleh, President of the International Association of Political Experts, thank you very much for joining us.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. The Islamic Revolution stood up against the U.S. The U.S. weren't willing to easily give up. Therefore, the plots began. From the very beginning of the revolution, the United States began its provocations against the Iranian nation. They were against the Iranian nation. They weren't just against the Islamic Republic. They were against the Iranian nation. The U.S. started by severing relations. The severance of ties was first started by the U.S. Then it started imposing sanctions, which were followed by various other actions one after another. Truly, anyone who knows, who remembers and doesn't forget what the U.S. has done over the years, realizes the truth of Imam Khomeini's statement, "Let out all your shouts on the U.S." The U.S.'s enmity toward Iran wasn't just a verbal enmity. It wasn't just a matter of sanctions. Their enmity was shown with their actions. The U.S. conspired against the Islamic Republic as much as they could and as far as they could. They helped the inherent enemies of the Islamic Republic as much as they could, and they harmed the interests of the Iranian nation wherever they were able to inflict damage.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The arrogant nature of the U.S. wasn't compatible with the independence-seeking nature of the revolution. This is what I want to emphasize. The conflict between the Islamic Republic and the U.S. isn't a difference in tactics. It isn't an incidental disagreement. It's an inherent difference. If they have the chance, the U.S. will shoot down an Iranian passenger plane with 300 passengers to fall into the sea. If they have the chance, they will compel someone like Saddam Hussein to attack Iran and will provide him with all kinds of support. If they have the chance, they will launch a direct attack on the country. If they have the chance, they will carry out all sorts of activities using propaganda against the